Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week, and we're lucky to have him, is our absolute favorite, Blair Horner, the Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. He's back again, and we're so happy to have him because nobody knows more about government in New York State than he does. Welcome back, Blair.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Okay, so let's start by asking the obvious question. You can't write about or study New York State government without knowing that the first thing that comes to your mind is Andrew Cuomo. Now, I said a long time ago that I expected Andrew Cuomo would be running for governor another time. What do you think of that proposition?
Well, I mean, he has a big fundraiser coming up at the end of the month, $10,000 donation to his reelection campaign. So he's certainly gearing up as if he's going to run for a fourth term.
That's a hell of a piece of roast beef for $10,000.
Yes, it is. It's a nice big slice. And, you know, the governor would be the first governor since Nelson Rockefeller to win a fourth term if he's able to do it. I'm not sure what's going to happen with his career. Obviously, he has a lot of issues that still have to play out that could impact his ability to run for a fourth term. You know, in politics, you're on offense or defense, and the best place to be is on offense. And that's where I think the governor's leaning forward as if he's going to run for a fourth term, because that gives him the most power in the process.
Well, if he's raising that money, you can bet. Now, this book issue has turned out to be something. As you may remember, Blair, I wrote an excellent book called Me and Mario, about Mario Cuomo, for which I received not one penny. Now, $5 million for a book, that's a lot, but it seems to me it's appropriate enough. If he wants to make $5 million, why not?
Well, I mean, he's a full-time employee of the government. He's not supposed to have an outside job. Any member of the executive branch that wants to make money on the side has to get approval from somebody. Sometimes it's just the ethics council within the agency itself. Sometimes you go to the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, the state's ethics watchdog. In this case, Governor Cuomo went to the ethics watchdog, requested that he get this deal, be allowed to have this deal. He never told him how much it was worth, as far as we know. And the decision was made at the staff level and then never went to the commissioners. $5 million is a lot of money for the highest paid governor in the state in the country. And it makes perfect sense that should be vetted well in advance. And the decision on whether or not he's allowed to do it should be based on, you know, what's in the public's best interest. So they laid out, as we understand it anyway, criteria for how he should write the book, which is he can't use any of his work time to do it. He wouldn't be allowed to use any staff to do it. And he wouldn't be allowed to use any state resources to do it. And those are all issues now that are in dispute because of recent media reports that appears anyway, that he may have violated those restrictions. So it's not so much the book deal per se, although it's a whopper. It is also sort of the ethical restrictions on any full-time employee working for the government to ensure there's no conflicts of interest.
And now you say they told him what he was allowed to do. I'm learning something from you, as I always do, Blair. Oh, you mean the Ethics Commission, when he went to them in the first place, they laid out the restrictions?
That's our understanding. I mean, the documents that have been made public, and there have been a lot, so we don't really know everything. But they said you can't use state resources. You can't be doing it on, you know, your work time. You can't be using staff, any of that kind of stuff to write the book. It has to be a labor of love that you do on the weekends or at night. And it's not entirely clear how that all played out. There have been media reports that many staff volunteered, quote unquote, to help him and went to the mansion to do it. And that there were some use of state resources, although the administration argues it was de minimis. So whether or not any of those things violate the agreement, I think, are unclear. But, you know, that's one of the issues in dispute that the governor has to work through if he wants to run for a fourth term.
Let's talk about the politics of the fourth term. One of the things I've always said, you can't beat somebody with no one. But, of course, George Pataki was the governor of New York for three times. So somebody got beaten by somebody who nobody knew.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're running against the three-term incumbent, you want it as best you can to be a referendum on the incumbent. I mean, even at the presidential level, the election of 2020, for example, was a referendum on the stewardship of Donald Trump and his administration. And so they have a record to run on, and you want to make sure that they have to defend it. And so in Pataki's case, many, many years ago now, it was a referendum on what was an unpopular governor at the time. Then Governor Mario Cuomo was running for a fourth term, and his polling numbers were sagging. I think they were in the 40s at that time. And so by running someone that no one really could tag, Pataki was a combination of a fiscal conservative but a green Republican candidate in the sense that he was pro-environment or talk that way. There really wasn't much to hit him with, and so really became a referendum on then-Governor Mario Cuomo, and he lost in that re-election effort. In this case, a little bit different. The state is bluer than it was in 1994, and Governor Andrew Cuomo's numbers have sagged, but they're really not into the danger zone yet, as far as I can tell. So we'll see what happens.
So let's do the obvious. Who can beat him? As I started by saying, you can't beat somebody with no one. The name on almost everybody's lips is Letitia James, Tish James, who is the, as Cuomo had been before her, the attorney general. And she's been doing a lot of important work. Can she beat him in a primary?
I mean, you're right that I think the governor's danger is really in the primary. It's unclear how the general plays out because, you know, as long as the Republicans have to run as the party of Donald Trump, they have a hard time in New York. But whether or not the attorney general would primary the governor, I think, hinges on lots of ifs. And a lot of them, we have no clue as to what's going to happen. Will the assembly vote to impeach? Will there be anything that comes out of the federal investigations of the nursing home data? Will there be a J-Cope insurrection against the book deal? And there's a lot of things we don't know. All of those, the governor, and then there are the various harassment claims made against the governor. The governor declares himself innocent in all of those things, and if that's the way it all turns out, then I don't know if James would want to take a crack at him. It depends on how wounded he is going forward, I think, in terms of her determination and whether or not she wants to pull the trigger and run.
Now, you mentioned J-Cope. There may be a few people listening out there that don't know what J-Cope is and don't know that the governor has a great deal to do with who sits on J-Cope, which is going to be making decisions about his ethical responsibilities.
Yeah, I mean, the Joint Commission on Public Ethics was created at the as the result of the advocacy of Governor Andrew Cuomo. And it is the third iteration in the last three decades of a state ethics watchdog, and like its predecessors, it has largely failed. And the reason is, in all cases, this is structured to be political, not independent. And so all the commissioners, for example, are picked either by the governor or the legislative leaders, and they are direct appointees to oversee the ethics of the people who appoint them. So that inherent conflict, that inherent flaw, leads to the agency being able to do its job, I think, to pop mid-level members of the executive branch or to go after lobbying interests. I don't think anybody's criticized them for any of that work, but it's been very hard for them to sort of muster the enthusiasm to go after any of the appointing authorities that have made the appointments. And so that structure, it's the way it's set up. It's set up to be a political creature, not an independent one, and that means it can't work.
Blair, you wrote a very interesting column, and it marks a critical anniversary in New York. It's the decision to allow young adults the right to vote. Believe it or not, I'm so old. This year marks the 50th anniversary of a landmark reform in American democracy. In 71, the nation approved the 26th Amendment, a chance that allowed 18 to 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds the right to vote. And that went into effect after three-quarters of the states approved the measure. The amendment was first approved by the Congress in March 71, and New York State approved the change June 2nd, 71, 50 years ago. I've been married for 50 years. What do you think? Why is this so critical to you?
Well, first of all, Alan, I mean, you weren't old enough at the time, of course, to it affect you, but it did affect me. And I recall very clearly at the time there was the war in Vietnam, and the issue then, old enough to fight, you should be old enough to vote, was a slogan that was really had resonated, particularly among young men during that period of time. And the sort of the interesting history of this is it goes back to the 1940s when then President Franklin Roosevelt lowered the draft age from 21 to 18. And that was the first time, actually, there was an effort to lower the voting age. And it came up periodically in the 40s and the 50s. President Eisenhower advanced it in 1954 in his State of the Union address. But it really came to a head in the late 1960s because that was at the end of a decade of youth activism that said, well, we're adults. We should be treated like adults and we should be able to vote like adults, particularly if you're asking us to go fight in a war. We want to be able to say, you know, who we believe should be making that decision. And so I think from a young adult's perspective, if you're old enough to sign contracts, old enough to get married, old enough to, you know, serve in the military, certainly you should be treated like an adult. And voting is the critical cornerstone of that because the policies being made that impact the youngest adults will impact them the longest. Things like how do you deal with climate change, whether or not we're in war or peace. There's a number of issues that young people care about, and they should be able to cast their ballot to express their point of view.
Now, you, of course, are the head of NYPIRG. That has lots of students in it.
Yep.
So the question is, to what degree do the kids themselves want to vote? I mean, I taught political science for 1,000 years, maybe 2,000, and getting a kid to get out and vote was one of the most difficult things in the world. Are you going to vote? Oh, yeah. Everybody's going to vote. But then they didn't. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, of course, you're absolutely right, by the way. Young adults are the least likely to vote of any segment of the adult population. And part of it is, you know, they don't really know what they're doing, right? They're 18 or 19 or 20 years old, and they're told they should go vote. You know, they think that's a good idea. And then when they want to go vote, they have to find out they have to register first. And they have to, and that's, there's a certain deadline to get the paperwork in, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that. And they don't understand the system. And so often they get boxed out because they don't understand the system. And part of it is deliberate obstacles that are put in place to keep them from voting. I mean, elected officials are elected officials because of the people who did vote. And bringing in a substantial number of new voters makes them all nervous. So I'll give you a very good example. I'm sorry.
Even if they're Democrats, they got there under the old system.
That's exactly right. And I'll give you a good example. No, I'll give you a good example. The state constitution says that you can't register to vote within 10 days of election day. The legislature and the governor years ago approved a law that says you can't register and vote within 25 days of election day. Well, why would they do that? Well, part of it could be administrative, of course. It's a hassle to deal with, you know, new voter registration forms coming into the State Board of Elections. But part of it is that people start to tune into politics, particularly new voters, the closer you get to an election. So New York has a 25-day blackout period before the election if you want to register to vote. And so there's a good example of where new voters are put at a disadvantage. New voters tend to be young voters.
Blair Horner, it's the end of the session. We all know that there's a lackadaisical process that the legislature goes through until the very end, and then all kinds of things happen. Got any insights for us?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. If you look at the data over time, the majority of the bills that get passed in a legislative session pass in the last 2 weeks of the legislative session. Like humans, they put everything off to the last minute. And if you're negotiating, you never want to really show your hand on any issue of consequence until the last minute, until the decision-making time's coming up. The legislative session is supposed to end at the end of next week. And so, you know, it's pedal to the metal time between Memorial Day and the middle of June. And so there's a lot of things that are going to be happening that's really hard to know. There's all sorts of sneaky things that could be happening. One of the major issues that it looks like they'll be debating is dealing with really crime. There's been a crime, increase in crime throughout the state, throughout the country,
indeed,
probably related to the pandemic. And so Democrats have a different point of view than Republicans. And the fighting over this, really, the Democrats are going to win because they have overwhelming majorities of both houses in terms of the legislative stuff. But what you're seeing really is this setup for the 2022 elections in New York, and the argument by Republicans being made you need more policing, the arguments being made by Democrats that you need a better social safety net and more accountability of gun manufacturers. And that sort of setup, I think, is really, that's to me, that's sort of the interesting thing and how that plays out. And it does, I think, foreshadow what the November 2022 elections are going to turn on.
You know, in New York City, I know you know a lot about the city and the state and the relationship and voting. You know, there's this transference of votes from your first to the second to the third favorites. How do you think that's going to affect the way that elections occur in New York City, and if it gets adopted in New York State, in New York State?
Well, the first thing is the polling doesn't really matter. I mean, for your listeners, New York City has a system called ranked choice voting. When you vote, you can choose up to five candidates and rank them in order. And so if none of the candidates get 50%, they count the votes, and then the top four make it, and then the number five votes get, you know, reassigned to the top four depending on how you rank them. And they keep working until one candidate gets 50%. And so New York City has a runoff system. I think the runoff system goes away because of that. And it's really hard to know from the polling. You can tell who's winning and who's losing, but the thing really that matters is who gets 50%. So someone who comes in third on the first round could end up being the candidate who is nominated by the Democrats or the Republicans in the primary later this month and then run again in November. So it's an interesting system, and it should mean that we won't know for probably a month who won unless somebody gets clearly 50% right away in the primary. And the polling is certainly going to be far less accurate than it has been in the past, because you don't really have the straight up head to head match. It'll be, and I think whatever candidate can stitch together the broadest coalition is going to be the one that ultimately wins.
You're so smart, Blair Horner, and I just wanted to say that so is our producer, David Gustina, who I know will be talking to a pollster, probably from Siena, pretty soon to find out what their problems are going to be and trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen where we didn't know. So, for example, Andrew Yang, very popular in the beginning, falling off now a little bit, but everybody attacked Andrew Yang in the beginning. So if what you're telling us about the way that ranked choice voting works is that if you don't get a second or a third or a fourth place, you're out. So maybe because everybody attacked Yang, he gets out.
Well, again, there's more than five candidates. So some of them will be out right off the bat. The really thing is, does any of the candidates get 50% out of the box? And if they do, then they win. So Yang, you know, he has an interesting, his coalition is going to be based on really, I think, a lot of votes from Queens, which has a high Asian American population. And Yang is Asian American, and I think appeals to that sort of ethnicity. As you know, Alan, you know, ethnicity, race, and gender often drive people's votes more than anything else. And he has this sort of sunny disposition, you know, so he really is a phenomenal campaigner. So we'll see how it all plays out. I mean, it's so hard to tell. The top three right now are not, it's not entirely clear where, since they're all attacking each other, where that impacts. Does it suppress, let's say, Yang again, let's say he comes up second and nobody gets 50%, but he's on everyone else's number five card. Does that mean that later on, as they go through the ballots and count up the ranked choice votes, that he drops even further? Or does it mean that, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, you don't poll on who's your top five. You poll on who's your top pick. And if nobody gets 50%, then it's a wild card.
Yeah, but of course, where you have ranked choice voting, everybody always has the option of only voting for one.
That's right.
Bullet
that's
voting, exactly. In other words.
Yeah, but then that's all they get, right? So their influence on who ultimately wins is limited if you do that once.
Yeah, you pay your money and you get your choice. Let's talk about marijuana for a little bit. Right before the budget passed, New York became the 16th state to legalize marijuana for adult recreational use. It's a bit tricky, though, when it comes to college campuses because of federal money and smoke-free policies. And I have to say, people call me all the time and they say, you should take underwriting from the pot people because it's now legal in New York and in Massachusetts. And I keep saying, yeah, but it ain't legal in Washington, in the federal government. It's still illegal. Okay. So we got our license from the feds. We would never do that. Interesting dichotomy between state and federal.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's that. I mean, you're absolutely right on all of those points. Also, dealing with the banking system is very tricky because the vast majority of banks are monitored by the federal government, and so they're not allowed to take drug money. I mean, at some level, at some point, the scales will tip as the baby boomers fill up all of the ranks of the vote of the older voters. You've already started to see it in states. I think ultimately a lot of these things will change even at the federal level. But in terms of college campuses, I mean, the law in New York is you can smoke pot recreationally. But you have to comply with the state's clean indoor air laws, no matter whatever it is you're smoking, tobacco or pot. And so that means, and college campuses tend to be smoke-free, by and large, not all of them, but they tend to be smoke-free. And so if there's smoke-free campuses for cigarettes, there's smoke-free areas for doobies. And so that's sort of that. And then, of course, you're right, they do rely on the federal government for funding, and they have to be sort of protected from the federal government's retribution. Now, there's a lot of things to do, and whether or not the federal government chooses to aggressively pursue these things or not, I think is going to depend on what the administration does. But by and large, everyone should know this. If it says you can't smoke cigarettes somewhere, it means you can't smoke pot there too. And that applies to colleges. It applies to workplaces, public places, restaurants, bars, and some areas walking around the streets.
Blair Horner, there's a lot of killings going on in New York State, my state of Massachusetts. People are dying. If the gun people are so powerful, what kind of laws can we pass in New York State or can be passed in New York State to make a difference in the number of guns that are out there?
Well, I mean, this is not an area of expertise for me, but it seems like there's lots of guns.
Oh, come on, you know everything.
There's lots of guns already out there, and I think the interesting thing that's being kicked around in Albany right now is to make the gun manufacturers liable for their own devices, and that they should do a better job of dealing with things like ghost guns, which is where you can buy component parts and it has no number on it, so they're really hard to trace. There's lots of, and you make them more legally responsible for their products. I mean, there's things you can do, but, you know, you really do need a federal strategy. And the vast majority of the rest of the advanced countries, of course, murders still happen, and sometimes they happen with guns. But there's nothing that compares to what happens in the United States. And part of that is the power of the gun manufacturers to protect themselves legally.
Yep.
And part of it is the incentive everybody has seemingly to go out and go buy them. And so there's, I think, more weapons per, I think there's more than one weapon per person in America right now.
I think
and
it's
so
three.
There you go, right? So to some extent, the genie's out of the bottle. And the question is, how do you track the devices? How do you crack down on the individuals who sell them and the criminals that use them?
Hey, we're almost out of time, but I did want to ask you about redistricting. New York is set to lose a congressional seat. 89 more people had answered the doorbell when the census was being taken. We wouldn't have lost one. But where's that likely to happen?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the issue, though, is, you know, how do they decide to do it? They meaning the legislature and the governor, because they ultimately control redistricting in New York. And you have supermajorities of Democrats in both houses. So I think it's a fair guess that the district on the chopping block will be a Republican one. And usually it's the easiest if you just sort of vaporize the district of somebody who's retiring, like Tom Reed in the Rochester Southern Tier area. But what the lines ultimately look like, they could be dramatically different if the legislature chooses to do it. And so I think upstate will lose a congressional seat because demography tells you that that's where the people have moved from. I mean, moved from or left, whatever they've done. There's upstate has lost population. New York City and the Hudson Valley has gained population. New York gained population according to the census, just not as fast as the rest of the country did, and that's why we're losing one. So it makes sense that upstate would lose one, but what the lines ultimately all look like will be a decision that's made, I think, by the governor and the legislature, you know, in the dark of night sometime in early 2022.
So we are out of time. I had lots of other questions to ask you about the environment and about all kinds of stuff. But you can be sure, Blair Horner, we'll be inviting you back to be our guest on the Capital Connection. We've been talking to Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair, I mean this. I mean it from the bottom of my heart. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me and contribute to WAMC.
Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.